Whitney, I know you're going to buy it, and a few months after you buy it, we're going to have an interesting conversation along these lines, Rich, in 2EO, C2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, and here we go. I'm almost quiet. It's not for Jeremy, it's this boy, Landon. He's going to be 8 on March 5th. That was a birthday gift, a thought of a gift.
C2IS comment.
Okay, go ahead, Bill.
I didn't catch everything, but I think this advice has been given already. There are very low-end quadcopters. You can get something for $25 or $50 that you could even fly around indoors as a way to sort of get you trained up. When you do get to more expensive units, there are things that have GPS guidance and, you know, sort of GPS assist in terms of you're just sort of flying stable, so you're less likely to crash into things. But of course, something with GPS guidance is going to be more expensive. And I have heard of situations that people who, you know, should have known what they were doing, accidentally set up their quadcopter to sort of fly to an unknown waypoint. So they had their quadcopter take off and just sort of disappear into the distance, never to be seen again. Those kinds of things do sometimes happen. Starting off with something that's cheap and that you could even just fly around indoors to sort of initially gain some skill is a good way to go. AC2IS.
Good information there, Bill. AC2IS, K2IW. Bill, you with your higher degrees in college and your highly skilled group of guys from Cold Spring Harbor, I think. I saw you guys flying quadcopters that you had homebrewed at Bethpage State Park, in that great big ball field of Bethpage State Park. And you guys were having a lot of trouble keeping that under control, not losing it in the woods, so to speak, and whatever. Yes, it was a homebrew version without some of these built-in automatic compensations. But even that, if you think back, Bill, is again evidence where if you're not getting skilled mentorism, these things can be very troublesome. AC2IS for some further comments on that. K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Back then, we were flying stuff that did not have any GPS features. It was scratch built. We tried building our own flight controller, but apparently, building a flight controller from scratch was way above our skill level. So we got eventually a commercial off-the-shelf flight controller. But because it was a scratch-built design, it was basically the frame of it was two pieces of aluminum U-channel from Home Depot, I believe. There was not a lot of protection to the unit, to the quadcopter itself. So a lot of our quote-unquote landings were, you know, more resembled crashes, and we went through quite a lot of props, but it was kind of nice having scratch built the thing that we knew where to get props. A lot of times, if you buy something from DJI, that's kind of the prominent brand out there, I don't know what they charge for replacement props. Probably it would be advisable for anyone getting a quadcopter to have an additional set of props. If you can buy that up front, not a bad idea. Eventually you're going to have some prop damage. And if that's going to put you out of commission and really kind of sour you on the sport, then I think you're way better off having those replacement props up front. So you're not completely out of commission. You have a way to get back in the air. Go ahead.
Now, when it comes to selecting the props that you're going to buy, they've got to be the right ones that match the machine, and know that the machine contains half of the props are right-handed and half of the props are left-handed. So whatever you think is the right number of spare props, you've got to have twice that number because some of them have to be right and some of them have to be left. So even among highly skilled people, they run into a fair amount of trouble. There's more ways you can get in trouble with these things. FAA trouble. There are people now making the mistake of flying them near airports, and they're about to be fined and or incarcerated if they come near commercial aircraft. So you're not supposed to go above 400 feet. You're not supposed to be within X number of miles of an airport. There are certain United States parks which specifically outlaw quadcopters in their park. So you're going to run into a lot of frustration, in my opinion, Rich, for an 8-year-old, I think his name is Brandon. For you, it's a fun-sounding toy. He's going to end up frustrated, I think. Maybe I'm just a little bit overly negative. N2EO, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Zulu.
Rich first. Go ahead, Rich. N2EO first.
Okay, Dick. Maybe I'll think of something else I want to get him. And something else I have to bring up concerning this little fella.
Okay, because you're speaking so close to that mic and your voice is being garbled, we missed the subject matter of your second subject. We'll come back to you in a minute. W2BZ, Rich number two. Go ahead, Rich number two.
Hi, maybe everybody's talked to you. If you do want to go with it, and yes, Dick, you're right. You do need somebody to show you, you know, what the controls do. And 8 years old is a little bit young. I would say, you know, unless you have somebody in the house who's into the hobby, then I think you better look at something else. So if you do go with it, look at, it's the number one selling manual quadcopter. It's called the SYMA, S-Y-M-A, X5C-1. It's something like $35 on Amazon, and you'll see like 26,000 or something like that have been sold. Just as a point of interest, let me drop, I don't know if you heard it before, because I think I doubled with that other guy. Let me drop a second. DJI's flagship they came out with it about 8 months ago, 9 months ago maybe, called a Phantom, Phantom 2 Pro, I think that's what it is. Has a Hasselblad camera on it. Did you guys hear me say what happened with that Hasselblad camera and really got egg on their face? Did you hear that, Dick?
Yeah, the DJI Phantom 2 is a really beautiful machine with a GPS and automatic home mode and a whole lot of fancy modes. And it's got a very high-quality camera on board, but I think you told us that it's only using a small fraction of the pixels that are in that camera in that downlink, is what I think you're telling us. W2 Bravo Zulu, K2LAW in the TechNet.
You did hear. So they have this Hasselblad camera that everybody was drooling over, and this machine with a one-inch, you know, full-frame CMOS sensor, they were telling everybody. But they weren't telling everybody they didn't have enough battery power on board to power, you know, a camera that's using a one-inch sensor. So they didn't tell anybody when they released this with the Hasselblad camera that they were only using a quarter of that sensor to conserve power. And now firmware fixes are rolling out. But it was a pretty big scandal for DJI for a while. I don't know where it stands now. Anyway, thanks. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Quick break, Bravo Zulu. The DJI Phantom 2, I think that's around $500. Is that true, Rich number 2?
Well, this is the Phantom 2 Pro, the Phantom 2 Pro that they came out with. And that thing's more like $1,800, $2,200. I forget. I didn't look at the price for, you know, haven't looked at the price for 6-7 months. I think it's around over $2,000, just over $2,000.
Okay, what's the price of the DJI, which doesn't have the super duper camera? The basic DJI, isn't that around $500? Go ahead.
I think it is. That's not the Pro, and they also have a new one that's not as great as the Phantom Pro 2, the Phantom 2 Pro. I forget what that is, but that's one below it. And then the one you were talking about, Dick, yeah, is the one below that, just the Phantom 2. Go ahead.
Okay, so there's a high probability you're going to run into a frustrating, difficult to control unit. If you're buying a $50 unit and you're willing to throw away $50, go for it. But the ones that are easier to control and fun to fly are closer to the $500 category, and even those require some darn good instruction if you don't want to lose it, damage it, and so on. There's a lot more. This toy is nowhere near as simple as the articles. I do recommend you go and look at those YouTube videos by Mr. Martucci. Over to you for a final on this one, Rich. N2EO, and then we got to go to the next person, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. I did want to ask you something. We'll keep it quick if we can, about this young fella.
Your voice is distorted, and we can't hear what you're saying is that second subject. From fella. What is a from fella?
I said about this little fella.
I still can't hear the word, but go ahead and ask your question. Maybe we'll figure it out.
Okay, well, I got the audio down. It shouldn't be bad. This little fella is getting fat. Months ago, I called the, DPS. Children's Protection Society. I expressly told them there's no problem, he's just overweight. Anyway, they came here, they did nothing. All they did was look him over for bruises and whatnot. The father is very overweight, between 400 and 500 pounds, if you can believe that. I have to get both of them to get their weight down, especially the father. I'm concerned I'll have a heart attack and die.
Remember, you told us you were not going to get into anything medical. I still can't understand the subject. Apparently, you're talking about an overweight human being, and maybe you're trying to tell us his name, and we can't hear that name, but you're into medical now. We're not supposed to be discussing medical, Rich. I'm going to go to the next person. Next person on our list was John. KC2SHO. Go right ahead, John.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Good evening, gentlemen. I was chatting with someone here, so I haven't been paying too much attention, but my comments tonight were on the your opening statement there, Dick. One of the things I found most useful, even for me being many years as an RF technician and slowly learning all these things over the years, the videos that I love to share even opened my eyes, and there's two of them that I love that really give a visual representation of what you were talking about with the impedance and the matching and the complex RLC network. Sorry, I wasn't that prepared to start talking. I just heard my call sign. One is the ATT Labs wave machine. And if you just type ATT Labs and wave into the YouTube image search, you will get a fantastic demonstration of wave propagation. And then if you want to see how that kind of translates into transmission lines, we talked about it before. I think I may have even brought it to the attention of the group here, and I think I've seen it posted on one of your web pages. There is the standing up for standing waves video. Absolutely fantastic way to demonstrate the very abstract things you were trying to explain in your opening there. Hope that's on point and useful, but that was my comments for the evening. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, at least one of the Roy's websites, one of his sub-sites on his web, will give you a mechanical analogy of a transmission line. It's a torsion rod, in other words, a long rod, which is being twisted, and it's got 1,000 horizontal rods every half inch across this long rod. And by twisting the long rod, you can watch the 1,000 horizontal rods go up and down in waves as they twist. And you can now represent mechanically standing waves and impedance inversion and whatever. One of the things that very few amateurs know, as I said earlier, is that if the load impedance, the antenna, is higher, like 100 ohms, than your transmission line, which is a 50 ohm transmission line, then the signal reflected from it is in phase at the antenna. By reflection, I mean it's going to send a signal back down in the opposite direction of the signal that went up to the antenna through the transmission line. If the impedance is lower, right at the antenna, it's going to be sending a signal back down that's out of phase. Your next question is, okay, what phase am I going to see in the shack? That gets complicated again. If the total length of the transmission line is a multiple of a half wave, then the impedance at the antenna and the impedance at the shack are almost identical if the line is low in loss. If the length of the transmission line, let me drop, if it's an odd number of quarter waves, quarter wave, three-quarter wave, five-quarter wave, if it's an odd number of quarter waves long, another inversion takes place. A 100-ohm load gives you an in-phase reflection at the antenna, but in the shack, you will see 25 ohms. If there is an odd number of transmission lengths, odd number of wavelengths, the wavelengths of the transmission line. So, because of the way standing wave works, if you take that mechanical analogy where you get this twisting, waving motion that you're viewing at that website, which is a beautiful way of getting a bit of a feel for what the voltage on the transmission line would look like if you could see voltage. At one instant of time, if you could stop all the action, somewhere along the transmission line there's a strong positive voltage, somewhere else along the transmission line, a half wave away, there's a strong negative voltage. A quarter wave from either one is 0 volts. So there's a sine wave of amplitude, positive and negative, if you stop the action. But in the real transmission line, that sine wave is constantly in motion. There is a sine wave going up toward the antenna. There's a sine wave coming back down if the antenna has any reflection. These two sine waves, in certain places, they're in phase, and you get a peak. Certain phases, they're out of phase, and you get a valley. And that's the so-called standing wave that you see with a slotted line. So there's a lot of magic going on inside of a transmission line. And how it does all this, let me drop. In the case of the use of your transmission, of your slotted line, which is a probe going into the slot with a diode detector on it, and the diode detector will see a high positive voltage. Well, there's another problem. The diode detector only gives you one voltage. If you had an RF oscilloscope on that probe, at certain places you would see a strong positive voltage as you move the probe along the slotted line. And you stop it at one particular place, you'll see a strong in-phase voltage. And you move it another half wave, and you'll see a strong out-of-phase voltage, sine wave, being picked up by that probe. And when you rectify it, which is the usual way the probe is used, you can't tell the difference between the in-phase and out-of-phase, because they both give the exact same response to a rectifier. But the probe is mixing together the forward-going wave and the reverse-going wave
That's how it knows in certain places things are in phase and certain other places they're out of phase. It's picking up the two and they're being mixed together in the probe. Let me drop. About a half inch away on the semiconductor of the slotted line, the so-called transmission line, the forward going wave and the reverse going wave are not being mixed together. On the transmission line, the forward going wave doesn't know there's a reverse going wave there. And the reverse going wave, the wave coming back down, doesn't know there's a voltage going forward. They do not mix on the transmission line. They're independent events. Crazy concept. And if you're really careful in the way you use that mechanical analogy, standing wave indicator, that the wavy line thing, you can see some of these properties. But there's a tremendous amount of magic going on inside of a transmission line. You probably only heard a certain fraction of that in your previous life up till now, John. And there's a lot more to the story. The number of the ways you can misunderstand standing wave on a transmission line is huge. There's a lot of people who believe that when you've got standing wave, you've got a lot more television interference. Absolutely not true. You've got a lot more radiation on the outside of the line. Absolutely not true. Whether or not you've got radiation on the outside of the line is a function of the way you do a balancing function where the transmission line meets your antenna. That phenomena is independent of standing wave ratio. A lot of people wouldn't believe that. KC2SHO, hope I'm not confusing you with all this, John. I hope I'm just creating some more curiosity about the magic inside transmission lines. You've got it, John. K2LIW.
Real good, Dick. No, there's no confusion at all. I've been at this for quite a while now. Jeez, I think about it. Yeah, somewhere near 20 years professionally. And, like you say, there's more to understand all the time. Fortunately, I have a very smart boss who, when I do run into things that still confuse me, although it's rare, he can help me get through some of those things. And it does happen, there's so many things happening. She's starting to understand, high order modes and things that are happening in our amplifiers. It's all so fascinating. There's tons to read and learn, and experience is helping me with that as well. But the machine you described is exactly the one in the first video. If you look up that AT&T Labs wave machine video, that's the one you described. It's a fascinating way to visualize waves, and you did a good job explaining it in words as well. But all right, let me get back to what I'm doing here. I do have a guest and a little project going on, but what else can I say? We learn more every day and aspire to keep going with that as long as I can. K2RIW, KC2SHO. Thank you, Dick.
That was John, KC2SHO from Los Alamos Laboratories, one of those high technology centers. The last person on our list who signed in with a nice, simple question that's going to be easy to understand is N2XJN. Wes, go ahead with your nice, simple question. I'm having some fun with Wes, as you can tell. You've got it, Wes. K2LIW.
What is the polarization of the antenna that you described?
If you were using the probe on an RF oscilloscope, say, for instance, you're operating at 100 megacycles, and with a transmission line, you're putting a signal into an antenna, and your oscilloscope works correctly at 100 megacycles, and you can display that sine wave on the screen. And this is a dual trace oscilloscope. So one of your probes is right at the transmitter, at the beginning of the transmission line. The other probe is at the antenna, at the some number of wavelengths of transmission line. And now you're looking at those two sine waves on the dual trace oscilloscope. And assuming that the transmission line is a half wavelength long or a multiple of a half wave, that's the magic length where the input impedance and the output impedance look the same if the insertion loss is low of the transmission line. You will see those two signals in phase with each other on the dual trace oscilloscope if the impedance of the antenna is higher than 50 ohms. If the impedance of the antenna is lower than 50 ohms, the two signals on that dual trace oscilloscope will be out of phase. I call that a negative signal versus a positive signal. In phase is positive, negative phase is, negative signal is out of phase. Relative words. Whenever you're using the word phase, there's got to be a reference somewhere. So one of those traces on the dual trace oscilloscope, you call it the reference, and you measure the phase and amplitude difference with reference to the other sine wave. Does that make a little more sense, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW?
It appears to be related to, in relation to something. How about polarization?
Okay. When it comes to an ordinary coaxial transmission line, there is no such thing as polarization. So why are you bringing that up at this time, Wes? Go ahead.
No, you were talking about a certain type of the antenna, and you described the antenna. And I was asking, what is the polarization of that antenna?
The polarization of the antenna is the polarization of the antenna. If you're using a horizontally polarized antenna, it's generating a horizontally polarized wave. You're changing the subject. We haven't been discussing polarization, and the way you ask the question only has a nonsensical answer. Over to you, Wes.
The first question was answered. I ask another question, unless I'm not entitled to ask the question. I'm trying to get more information about the polarization. If you have antenna that you describe, does that antenna have a circular polarization?
Wes, you've got to put yourself in our shoes. When we're discussing an antenna and phase and polarity, and you want to discuss polarization, you got to give us a hint. You've got to tell us, I'm changing the subject. I'm opening a brand new subject called polarization. You didn't tell us that. We're discussing coaxial transmission line and voltages and phases, and without telling us, you ask polarization. And now you're saying you want to discuss polarization. Okay. Ask a question about polarization. Now that you've told me you're on a second subject, you got to give us a hint. That's some of the confusion. You got to put yourself in our shoes, Wes. We're not inside your head. We're not a mind reader. N2XJN, K2LIW. I wish I was.
I do thank you very much for pointing at that. I didn't want it to create a confusion. There are certain limitations in my English. So you have polarization of the antenna. You could have a vertically horizontally polarized signal. Now, you could have a circularly... Okay. So I'm mixing two words, polarization and polarity. Okay. Let me drop. Thank you for pointing that. Now, another question that I have is, this is the last question. Slow wave. If I have 1/100 of the wavelength of the antenna, that means the antenna is 3.2 megahertz, I'm putting 15 kilohertz on it, whatever. Then I'm dealing with a slow wave. But is that what I can read from the literature? Would you please give me more information about the slow waves and to exit?
When a radio wave or an electromagnetic wave, whether it be light or radio wave, is traveling through a vacuum of space, it travels at the speed of light. If that wave is traveling through almost any other medium, a piece of plastic, a piece of wood, a dense atmosphere, air with a lot of moisture in it. Any other medium that that light wave or that radio wave is traveling through, it's going to be slowed down in propagation speed compared to the speed of light. If you know the dielectric constant of the medium, if, for instance, a piece of plastic with a dielectric constant of 3, let's make it 4, a dense piece of plastic with a dielectric constant of 4, 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant is the velocity of propagation. So I'm using plastic with a dielectric constant of 4. That means if I put that piece of plastic between two plates of a capacitor, and it's got a dielectric constant of 4, whatever the capacitance of the capacitor used to be, it's now 4 times greater. That's what that really means. You put a piece of plastic between those two plates, the capacitance in picofarads goes up by 4-to-1 ratio. Most likely your plastic has a dielectric constant of 4. Take the square root of 4, it's 2. The signal going through the piece of plastic, whether it be light or radio, will travel at half the speed of light. That's a slow wave. That's one of a zillion ways of making a slow wave, by controlling the dielectric constant of the medium. There's another way. Let me drop. I can take a piece of transmission line, like coaxial cable, and now every inch along that cable, I hang a 10 picofarad capacitor. Every inch, I hang a 10 picofarad capacitor from center conductor to the outer shield. And I do that for 100 feet of cable. I have now made an artificial slow wave structure. The signal going down the transmission line will now move a lot slower than it did before I added those capacitors. Those capacitors I added is another way of creating with components what looks like a high dielectric medium. If that 4-to-1 dielectric constant plastic fills up the airspace in my transmission line, my coaxial cable transmission line will have a velocity factor of 1/2. It will be slowed down by 2-to-1, 1 over the square root of 4. So those are ways of generating a so-called slow wave. The slow wave can be anything from 0.999 speed of light all the way down to 0.001 if I use the right kind of a structure. There's a zillion ways I can make any velocity factor you want of a slow wave. That's a little bit of the philosophy, science, of a so-called slow wave or a slow wave structure. There's a lot more to it, particularly when you start getting into the chirality of circular polarization and ellipticity of waves. And we ain't going to go there tonight. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
So in other words, you're saying the slow wave in transmission line is the one which travels with the phase velocity equal or less than certain pre-designed velocity of wave propagation. N2XJN.
Yes. The word phase needs a reference. The word velocity needs a reference. In the case of velocity factor and slow wave, 99% of the time, the reference is the speed of that wave in a vacuum. They usually call that the V0. And your wave in your transmission line is going to move at a velocity of V0 divided by the square root of the dielectric constant of the dielectric material between the center conductor and the shield. Life gets a little bit more complicated if you have more than one material in that transmission line. And you can do that as different materials along the length, or you can do it with a small diameter of high density plastic near the center conductor and a larger diameter of low density plastic near the outer conductor. So there's all kinds of fancy ways you can modify a coaxial transmission line, a strip line, a thin line. I mean, there's 15 kinds of transmission lines, and there's all kinds of ways you can modify their velocity factors by changing the mechanical configuration of the transmission line and or putting dielectric materials in or nearby. I can make thin line in a vacuum, but by the way I design the mechanical layout of that thin line, I could convert it into a slow wave structure. N2XJN, K2RIW.
At the beginning of TechNet, you mentioned a 221 SWR, and you said that in certain conditions we have a phase reversal for the standing wave, and for the certain condition you not. Would you please give me a few words more about it?
When the load, the antenna, is a perfect 50 ohm resistor at your operating frequency, all of that signal going down a 50 ohm characteristic impedance transmission line, all of that signal goes down the line once, goes into the antenna, all of it gets absorbed by the antenna, none of it reflects back. If the impedance at your operating frequency, your impedance of the antenna, is anything but a 50.00 ohm resistor, you're going to get some amount of reflected signal. If in the case I used of these two examples of where the antenna is either a 100 ohm resistive load or a 25 ohm resistive load, we call that a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. It's going to be generating a reflected signal, which quite often is called rho. And the impedance you see is 1 minus rho over 1 plus rho. It's a ratio. In the case of a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, the voltage that gets reflected back down will be 1/3 of the voltage you put on the transmission line. Put 9 volts on that transmission line, and because it has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 3 volts will be reflected back down. The signal going back down in the reverse direction will have a magnitude of 3 volts. And at certain places on that line, the 3 volts coming back down and the 9 volts going up are in phase with each other, and you see 12 volts. At some other place, they're out of phase with each other, and you see 6 volts. And notice that 6 volts is the valley and 12 volts is...
Repeater, timeout.
6 volts is the valley voltage on that length, on that location on the slotted line. 12 volts is the peak voltage at some other place. The ratio between the peak and the valley is 6 over 12, 12 over 6. It's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Now you know what a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio means. At the places where the voltages are in phase, you get a certain high voltage on your probe of your slotted line. At some other place, when you slide the probe, you get a minimum voltage. And when you go through the mathematics, you'll find out the forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal have a 3-to-1 ratio when the impedance is wrong by 2-to-1. And it can be wrong by 2-to-1 by being either 25 ohms of resistive antenna or 100 ohm of resistive antenna. But now, where on the slotted line do you see the peak and where do you see the valley? Those two positions are going to move by 1/2 wave on the specific locations on that slotted line when you flip from a 100 ohm load on the line versus a 25 ohm. So when you work out the mathematics of what happened, how come the peak and the valley moved? You find out that the signal reflected from the antenna was in phase with the ingoing signal, or the reflected signal is out of phase, depending on whether the impedance of the antenna is high or low. So let me drop. A smart person using a slotted line will put a calibrated load on the slotted line of 100 ohms and measure where the peaks and valleys on the slotted line of the probe are located and how strong are the peaks and valleys. Then he puts on a 25 ohm load and again measures. He has now calibrated his slotted line. He now takes off the calibration 100 ohm resistor and the calibration 25 ohm resistor. He takes them away. He puts his unknown antenna there and now he moves the probe and finds out where is the peak and where is the valley. The magnitude of the peak and the valley tells him how mismatched his antenna is. The location of the peak and the valley tells him, is it a 100 ohm resistor or is it a 25 ohm resistor that he just put on there, the unknown antenna. So by knowing the location of a peak and valley tells him high impedance or low impedance of the load. And if the location is halfway in between the two calibration points, he now knows he's got some reactance in the antenna. And again, by knowing the exact location, he can find out how much of a capacitor or how much of an inductor is the antenna impedance. That slotted line properly calibrated, it's a very primitive tool, very simple tool. Just a movable piece of wire, a crystal detector, into a voltage measuring machine, a digital voltmeter. But once properly calibrated, that slotted line gives you all the information you would have gotten out of a $10,000 vector network analyzer. And you're doing it with a piece of equipment you can build.
Repeater, timeout.
You could homebrew a slotted line with a very small number of dollars. There's some fancy mathematics required to calibrate it and figure out what's going on, but it can give you all of the information you would get out of a $10,000 vector network analyzer. But it's a lot slower. And there's only 10 ways you can make a mistake. Did I move the probe a little bit further downrange or uprange? Did I see a slightly higher voltage or a slightly lower voltage? There's a zillion ways you can go wrong. Whereas with the vector network analyzer, when it is properly calibrated, the microprocessor inside does a whole lot of individual algorithms and gives you an exact answer printed out on that screen or displayed as a graph on that screen. So the vector network analyzer allows you to do the work 100 times faster, but not necessarily better. The slotted line, properly used by a smart RF engineer, tells you everything you want to know if you're willing to spend the time to make the measurements and do the calibrating. That's a little bit more of the story. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
What is the difference between quarter wavelength of the antenna versus 1/100th of the wavelength? N2XJN.
If the antenna is 100 feet long, as a half-wave dipole, which would probably be true at something like 4.5 megahertz, that's the full half wavelength. It's 100 feet long. If I only construct 1 foot of that dipole instead of 100 feet of it, I've now got 1/100th of a half wave. I've got 1/200th of a wavelength of antenna. And your next question is, will that radiate? And the answer is yes. You give me the right kind of an antenna impedance matching device, and I can radiate 99% of that energy with an antenna that's only 1 foot long instead of 100 foot long. I didn't say it's easy. It would take an extremely high quality, very low insertion loss antenna impedance matcher, an antenna analyzer is not the right word, antenna tuner. What the antenna tuner is doing is taking the antenna, in my example, that's only 1/200th of a wavelength long, forcing it into resonance by the components of that antenna tuner. Then it can radiate. You resonate first, then it will radiate. Those magic words are not said in any book that I know about. If you're an antenna designer, those are the most important words in your vocabulary. You must resonate the antenna if you want it to be an efficient radiator. You can take an antenna of any number of fractions of a wavelength, or any number of wavelengths, force it into resonance if you have a large enough tuning range of your antenna tuner. Most people and most books will lead...
Repeater, timeout.
Most books and most articles will lead you to believe that if the antenna is not the right length, it will not radiate. in the old days before we had antenna tuners as being a popular instrument, that was sort of true. You allow me to use a high-quality antenna tuner today, and I can force anything that you can think of into being a efficient antenna. Any old ratty piece of conductor can be made into an efficient antenna if you give me a large enough tuning range of a high-quality antenna tuner. That's if it's a conductor. Even if the antenna is a non-conductor, that dense piece of plexiglass that I used previously, the 4-to-1 dielectric constant plastic, I can force that into being a dielectric guided antenna if you give me the right environment that I can mount it into. I didn't say it's easy. Therefore, almost anything can be made into an antenna. You give me the right kind of an antenna tuner with the right kind of a smart antenna savvy engineer, I can take anything that's in your shack and convert it into an antenna, including the knob that's on the front panel of that radio in front of you. N2XJN, K2RIW.
The antenna that is lesser than the wavelength, and in this particular example was 1/100th of the wavelength, is the slow wave structure. That at least what I have from the literature. So it's a circuit or transmission path where the phase velocity is much less than the speed of light. And one of the examples of this is helix, so we're talking about a coil. And my question to you is, if I have, let me jump.
Some of what you said is not right.
Go ahead, please, correct me.
A helical antenna is a very popular kind of slow wave structure. If my definition of, I could mount that helix into a vacuum. And if my definition of how strong, what is the speed of the signal going down the axis of the helix, if the helix has a pitch of 45 degrees, that's the angle of a section of that helix, then it could be a move slower because it's moving in that circle of the helical coil at a slant angle. The fact that it does not slow down the wave coming out of that antenna. Yes, the antenna, because it is shorter than resonant length, it gives me an impedance that's capacitive. Let me drop. So the antenna is a capacitive load. Whenever I put a capacitive load on the end of a transmission line, the signal that's reflected back down the transmission line, let me think now, is that delayed in phase or is it advanced in phase?
Delayed in phase.
It's advanced in phase. The signal coming out of the antenna is delayed. The signal reflected back down is advanced. Ain't that crazy? And when you mix together the signal being reflected back down and the signal going out, they give you a neutral if you mix the two together as a vector. So when you talk about phase, we're talking about the radiated signal or the reflected signal back down the transmission line. So when you call a short antenna a slow wave structure, yes, it is a slow wave radiator. It is a fast wave reflector. N2XJN, K2RIW. It's got to be confusing to you.
Absolutely it's not. It's a slow wave structure. It's a high velocity wave reflector. That's what you said. N2XJN.
No, it's not a high velocity reflector. It gives you a signal that is advanced in phase as a reflector. But the signal going down the transmission line goes at the normal transmission line speed. If my transmission line is RG8 coax, which has got a velocity factor of 66%, the signal going up the transmission line travels at 66% the speed of light. The reflected signal in that transmission line coming back down is also 66% of the speed of light. The so-called antenna that you're calling a slow wave or a fast wave structure In the advancing of the phase it reflects, or the advancing or retarding of the phase that it radiates, it is a phase-shifting device. Once it has done that shift of the signal radiated or the signal reflected, the signal that's radiated in free space, a vacuum, would travel at the normal speed in that vacuum. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Thank you for explaining me that. What I understand is that helix, in helix, the velocity reduction in the ratio to the pitch of the helix to the circumference creates slow wave.
You've got it. The majority of the slow wave function of a helix is a mechanical, the slant angle of the helix wire, how tightly it's wound. That's the majority of the slow wave structure of a helix. However, in most cases, you're going to wind the helix on a piece of tubing, maybe a piece of PVC pipe. The dielectric constant of the PVC pipe is going to slow down the signal traveling along the wire of the helix. So there's two things creating a slow wave function. The dielectric constant of the material you wind it on, and the pitch of the helix. But you, as an antenna designer of the helix, can change the pitch of the winding, the diameter of the winding, the dielectric constant of the tubing you wind it on, the thickness of the wall of the tubing you wind it on, and maybe even the diameter of the wire you're using. You've got a bunch of variables in your hand that you have control over, if you're smart enough, when you wind that helix antenna. Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
You have a wire in a dielectric insulation, like an electrical wire, and you're winding the helix with it. I assume that dielectric will have a significant reduction in velocity of the wave versus the enamel wire. N2XJN.
The answer is yes, but nowhere near as much as you think. If I'm winding my helix so that it has approximately one wavelength per turn, and I'm doing it at 100 megahertz, let me think now, 100 megahertz, 3 meters is the wavelength, 1.5 meters, yeah. If I wind it so that 3 meters per circumference, one wavelength per turn, and I do it at a certain pitch, the thickness of the rubber on the wire compared to a 3 meter wavelength is such a small number of wavelengths of thickness that the rubber insulation on the wire will probably slow down the signal going along the wire by 1 or 2%, nowhere near as much as you think. Until the rubber on the wire starts becoming a substantial portion of the wavelength you're operating at. When the thickness of the rubber starts becoming a quarter wavelength thick, now you're going to get some real slowdown of the wave. But you and I don't use wire with 4-inch diameter rubber on it, if you know what I mean. So you're going to see a difference with the rubber, but a lot less than would make common sense. Over to you, Wes, K2LAW. And by the way, when you wind that wire on your Tesla coil, you've got enamel on that wire. The thickness of that enamel is so thin that it almost doesn't count as to a factor of the slow wave function. The pitch of the wire and the diameter of the wire on that coil, on your Tesla coil, that's where the slow wave is coming from. Over to you, Wes, K2LAW.
It's a great help that you're giving me. The additional slowing of the wave could be achieved by changing the direction of the winding. In other words, is I'm going up towards the former, and then all of a sudden I'm going down, and then I'm going up. Did you ever get across this technique of slowing wave?
Intuition. first I thought you were winding a Tesla coil, where you start off at the bottom and you're winding it clockwise, and then a quarter of the way up you decide to start winding it counterclockwise. You reverse the direction. That's one way of going. Another way is you're winding it and you're going up the coil, and you decide to start going back down, still going clockwise, and you're making two layers of turns. And now you're getting capacitive coupling between those layers. There's a zillion ways you can do it. The majority of people who wind a Tesla coil do it with one layer of winding. There's a number of disadvantages you get with multiple layers on that high voltage coil. Over US, K2LIW.
I don't even know how to express my thank you to you. And it's not because I didn't know, it's because you said it. It is actually you who were my teacher at the beginning of it. It's great. That was what I was looking for, this kind of answer. Thank you very much for your help.
Hey, Roy, we've got a satisfied customer tonight. And we kept it without getting too ambiguous. We'll have to send him a bill. We're going to go over to the science section, which I'm very, very late in switching over to. Roy, AC2GS, with a beautiful puzzle. And you guys, put on your thinking caps. Get ready to start talking. Roy likes participation. He doesn't want a quiet audience, just sitting there where he puts on the show and you sit there and watch the movie. That's not what Roy likes. Roy wants you to join. Don't worry about making a wrong answer. There are no wrong answers. We're all in the learning curve here. Mother Nature has given us a universe that's very... There is a scientist trying to get out. The only way that scientist can get back out is to ask dumb questions and get some answers and say, oh, is that the way it works? And Roy is a very good teacher along those lines. So make sure you give him some dumb answers that we can work on and teach each other what Mother Nature is telling us about this complicated universe. AC2GS with the science talk. K2RIW and TechNet. You've got it, Roy. And does anybody know what the score is on the football game? You got it, Roy.
Dick, NCWO. Let me say, I didn't have a medical question per se.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You were starting to ask about somebody's health. That is medical. How can health be not medical, Rich?
Well, I just wanted to get some opinions from the audience. That's all.
That's the subject of health, and that is a verboten subject. You've been told that a large number of times by Rich, among other people. You're not supposed to do it over a repeater. AC2GS, K2I, go ahead with puzzle number one, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. And by the way, someone should have taken you up on that bet that you offered at the beginning of the TechNet. Like my father, I have no interest at all in sports. And one of the great things that I like about this hobby is that all my kindred spirits out there seem to feel the same way. So I feel buoyed by their apathy towards it all as well. So I don't have a clue who's winning or who won or any of that. I have six screens here. I could probably put it on one of them, but I'd rather put other stuff on my screen. Anyway, let me just remind everyone that if you want to send me any topics, any questions, or any comments at all, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to look at any links, any articles that I allude to, I post them on a website. You just go into your web browser and you type the phrase roy.ac2gs.com, and you'll get my link page. And in addition, if you type chat.ac2gs.com, you get into the TechNet chat room where we have a kind of a show within a show. So keep all those facts and figures in mind, and let me drop, and I'll mention the first link I have up there on my website. Okay, last week I posted a very nice image of Ultima Thule taken by the New Horizons. Now, this week I offer, for anyone so interested, a image of an asteroid called Bennu, taken by the asteroid orbiting OSIRIS-REx spacecraft. They took the picture January 17th of this year. So